button or by a representative as the medium of circulation, is money. Gold or silver is therefore money. It functions as money on the one hand when it has to be present in its own golden person. It is then the money commodity, neither merely ideal as in its function of a measure of value, nor capable of being represented as in its function of circulating medium. On the other hand, it also functions as money, when by virtue of its function, whether that function be performed in person or by representative, it congeals into the sole form of value, the only adequate form of existence of exchange value, in opposition to use value, represented by all other commodities. A. Hoarding. The continual movement in circuits of the two antithetical metamorphoses of commodities, or the never-ceasing alternation of sale and purchase, is reflected in the restless currency of money, or in the function that money performs of a perpetuum mobile of circulation. But so soon as the series of metamorphoses is interrupted, so soon as sales are not supplemented by subsequent purchases, money ceases to be mobilized. It is transformed, as Bois Guilbert says, from meuble into immeuble, from movable into immovable, from coin into money. With the very earliest development of the circulation of commodities, there is also developed the necessity and the passionate desire to hold fast the product of the first metamorphosis. This product is the transformed shape of the commodity, or its gold chrysalis. Footnote. Monetary wealth is nothing but wealth in products, transformed into money. Mercier de la Rivière. A value in the form of products which has merely changed its form. End of footnote. Commodities are thus sold not for the purpose of buying others, but in order to replace their commodity form by their money form. From being the mere means of effecting the circulation of commodities, this change of form becomes the end and aim. The changed form of the commodity is thus prevented from functioning as its unconditionally alienable form, or as its merely transient money form. The money becomes petrified into a hoard, and the seller becomes a hoarder of money. In the early stages of the circulation of commodities, it is the surplus use values alone that are converted into money. Gold and silver thus become of themselves social expressions for superfluity or wealth. This naive form of hoarding becomes perpetuated in those communities in which the traditional mode of production is carried on for the supply of a fixed and limited circle of home wants. It is thus with the people of Asia, and particularly of the East Indies. Van der Lint, who fancies that the prices of commodities in a country are determined by the quantity of gold and silver to be found in it, asks himself why Indian commodities are so cheap. Answer, because the Hindus bury their money. From 1602 to 1734, he remarks, they buried 150 millions of pounds sterling of silver, which originally came from America to Europe. Footnote. "'Tis by this practice they keep all their goods and manufactures at such low rates." Van der Lint. In the 10 years from 1856 to 1866, England exported to India and China £120 million in silver, which had been received in exchange for Australian gold. Most of the silver exported to China makes its way to India. As the production of commodities further develops, every producer of commodities is compelled to make sure of the nexus rerum, or the social pledge. Footnote. Money is a pledge. John Bellars, Essays about the Poor, Manufactures, Trade, Plantations, and Immorality. 1699. End of footnote. His wants are constantly making themselves felt, and necessitate the continual purchase of other people's commodities, while the production and sale of his own goods require time and depend upon circumstances. In order, then, to be able to buy without selling, he must have sold previously without buying. This operation, conducted on a general scale, appears to imply a contradiction. But the precious metals at the sources of their production are directly exchanged for other commodities. And here we have sales, by the owners of commodities, without purchases, by the owners of gold or silver. Footnote. A purchase, in a categorical sense, implies that gold and silver are already the converted form of commodities, or the product of a sale. End of footnote. And subsequent sales by other producers, unfollowed by purchases, merely bring about the distribution of the newly produced precious metals among all the owners of commodities. In this way, all along the line of exchange, hoards of gold and silver of varied extent are accumulated. With the possibility of holding and storing up exchange value in the shape of a particular commodity arises also the greed for gold. Along with the extension of circulation increases the power of money, that absolutely social form of wealth ever ready for use. Gold is a wonderful thing. Whoever possesses it is lord of all he wants. By means of gold, one can even get souls into paradise. Columbus, in his letter from Jamaica, 1503. Since gold does not disclose what has been transformed into it, everything, commodity or not, is convertible into gold. Everything becomes saleable and buyable. The circulation becomes the great social retort into which everything is thrown, to come out again as a gold crystal. Not even are the bones of saints, and still less are more delicate res sacrosancti, extra commercium hominum, able to withstand this alchemy. Footnote. Henry III, most Christian king of France, robbed cloisters of their relics, and turned them into money. It is well known what part the despoiling of the Delphic temple by the Phocians played in the history of Greece. Temples with the ancients served as the dwellings of the gods, of commodities. They were sacred banks. With the Phoenicians, a trading people par excellence, money was the transmuted shape of everything. It was, therefore, quite in order that the virgins, who, at the feast of the goddess of love, gave themselves up to strangers, should offer to the goddess the piece of money they received. End of footnote. Just as every qualitative difference between commodities is extinguished in money, so money, on its side, like the radical leveller that it is, does away with all distinctions. Footnote. Gold, yellow, glittering, precious gold, thus much of this will make black white, foul fair, wrong right, base noble, old young, coward valiant. What's this, you gods? Why, this will lug your priests and servants from your sides, pluck stout men's pillows from below their heads. This yellow slave will knit and break religions, bless the accursed, make the whore leprosy adored, place thieves, and give them title, knee, and approbation. With senators on the bench, this is it, that makes the wapened widow wed again. Come, damned earth, though common whore of mankind. Shakespeare, Timon of Athens. End of footnote. But money itself is a commodity, an external object, capable of becoming the private property of any individual. Thus social power becomes the private power of private persons. The ancients therefore denounced money as subversive of the economic and moral order of things. Footnote. Money, Nothing worse in our lives, so current, rampant, so corrupting. Money, you demolish cities, root men from their homes. You train and twist good minds and set them on the most atrocious schemes. No limit, you make them adept at every kind of outrage, every godless crimes. Money. Sophocles, Antigone. Modern society, which soon after its birth pulled Plutus by the hair of his head from the bowels of the earth, greets gold as its holy grail, as the glittering incarnation of the very principle of its own life. Footnote. The desire of avarice to draw Pluto himself out of the bowels of the earth. The Deipnosophists, Athenaeus. A commodity, in its capacity of a use value, satisfies a particular want and is a particular element of material wealth. But the value of a commodity measures the degree of its attraction for all other elements of material wealth, and therefore measures the social wealth of its owner. To a barbarian owner of commodities, and even to a West European peasant, value is the same as value form, and therefore to him the increase in his hoard of gold and silver is an increase in value. It is true that the value of money varies, at one time in consequence of a variation in its own value, at another in consequence of a change in the values of commodities. But this, on the one hand, does not prevent 200 ounces of gold from still containing more value than 100 ounces, nor, on the other hand, does it hinder the actual metallic form of this article from continuing to be the universal equivalent form of all other commodities, and the immediate social incarnation of all human labour. The desire after hoarding is in its very nature unsatiable. In its qualitative aspect, or formally considered, money has no bounds to its efficacy. That is, it is the universal representative of material wealth, because it is directly convertible into any other commodity. But at the same time, every actual sum of money is limited in amount, and therefore, as a means of purchasing, has only a limited efficacy. This antagonism between the quantitative limits of money and its qualitative boundlessness continually acts as a spur to the hoarder in his Sisyphus-like labour of accumulating. It is with him as it is with a conqueror who sees in every new country annexed only a new boundary. In order that gold may be held as money and made to form a hoard, it must be prevented from circulating or from transforming itself into a means of enjoyment. The hoarder, therefore, makes a sacrifice of the lusts of the flesh to his gold fetish. He acts in earnest up to the gospel of abstention. On the other hand, he can withdraw from circulation no more than what he has thrown into it in the shape of commodities. The more he produces, the more he is able to sell. Hard work, saving, and avarice are, therefore, his three cardinal virtues, and to sell much and buy little, the sum of his political enemy. Footnote. These are the pivots around which all the measures of political economy turn. The maximum possible increase in the number of sellers of each commodity, and the maximum possible decrease in the number of buyers. Veri. By the side of the gross form of a hoard, we find also its aesthetic form in the possession of gold and silver articles. This grows with the wealth of civil society. Soyons riches ou paraissons riches. Diderot. In this way there is created, on the one hand, a constantly extending market for gold and silver, unconnected with their functions as money, and on the other hand, a latent source of supply, to which recourse is had principally in times of crisis and social disturbance. Hoarding serves various purposes in the economy of the metallic circulation. Its first function arises out of the conditions to which the currency of gold and silver coins is subject. We have seen how, along with the continual fluctuations in the extent and rapidity of the circulation of commodities and in their prices, the quantity of money current unceasingly ebbs and flows. This mass must, therefore, be capable of expansion and contraction. At one time, money must be attracted in order to act as circulating coin. At another, circulating coin must be repelled in order to act again as more or less stagnant money. In order that the mass of money actually current may constantly saturate the absorbing power of the circulation, it is necessary that the quantity of gold and silver in a country be greater than the quantity required to function as coin. This condition is fulfilled by money taking the form of hoards. These reserves serve as conduits for the supply or withdrawal of money to or from the circulation, which in this way never overflows its banks. Footnote. There is required for carrying on the trade of a nation a determinate sum of specific money which varies, and is sometimes more, sometimes less, as the circumstances we are in require. This ebbing and flowing of money supplies and accommodates itself, without any aid of politicians. The buckets work alternately. When money is scarce, bullion is coined. When bullion is scarce, money is melted. Sir D. North. John Stuart Mill, who for a long time was an official of the East India Company, confirms the fact that in India silver ornaments still continue to perform directly the functions of a hoard. The silver ornaments are brought out and coined when there is a high rate of interest, and go back again when the rate of interest falls. J.S. Mills's Evidence. Reports on Bank Acts, 1857. According to a parliamentary document of 1864 on the gold and silver import and export of India, the import of gold and silver in 1863 exceeded the export by 19,367,764 pounds. During the 8 years immediately preceding 1864, the excess of imports over exports of the precious metals amounted to 109,652,917. During this century, far more than £200 million has been coined in India. End of footnote. B. Means of Payment. In the simple form of the circulation of commodities hitherto considered, we found a given value always presented to us in a double shape, as a commodity at one pole, as money at the opposite pole. The owners of commodities came therefore into contact as the respective representatives of what were already equivalents. But with the development of circulation, conditions arise under which the alienation of commodities becomes separated, by an interval of time, from the realization of their prices. It will be sufficient to indicate the most simple of these conditions. One sort of article requires a longer, another a shorter, time for its production. Again, the production of different commodities depends on different seasons of the year. One sort of commodity may be born on its own marketplace, another has to make a long journey to market. Commodity owner number one may therefore be ready to sell before number two is ready to buy. When the same transactions are continually repeated between the same persons, the conditions of sale are regulated in accordance with the conditions of production. On the other hand, the use of a given commodity, of a house, for instance, is sold, in common parlance, let, for a definite period. Here, it is only at the end of the term that the buyer has actually received the use value of the commodity. He therefore buys it before he pays for it. The vendor sells an existing commodity, the purchaser buys as the mere representative of money, or rather of future money. The vendor becomes a creditor, the purchaser becomes a debtor. Since the metamorphosis of commodities, or the development of their value form, appears here under a new aspect, money also acquires a fresh function. It becomes the means of payment. The character of creditor, or of debtor, results here from the simple circulation. The change in the form of that circulation stamps buyer and seller with this new die. At first, therefore, these new parts are just as transient and alternating as those of seller and buyer, and are in turns played by the same actors. But the opposition is not nearly so pleasant, and is far more capable of crystallization. Footnote. The following shows the debtor and creditor relations existing between English traders at the beginning of the 18th century. Such a spirit of crudity reigns here in England among the men of trade that is not to be met with in any other society of men, nor in any other kingdom of the world. An Essay on Credit and the Bankrupt Act, 1707. End of footnote. The same characters can, however, be assumed independently of the circulation of commodities. The class struggles of the ancient world took the form chiefly of a contest between debtors and creditors, which in Rome ended in the ruin of the plebeian debtors. They were displaced by slaves. In the Middle Ages, the contest ended with the ruin of the feudal debtors, who lost their political power together with the economic basis on which it was established. Nevertheless, the money relation of debtor and creditor that existed at these two periods reflected only the deeper lying antagonism between the general economic conditions of existence of the classes in question. Let us return to the circulation of commodities. The appearance of the two equivalents, commodities and money, at the two poles of the process of sale, has ceased to be simultaneous. The money functions now, first as a measure of value in the determination of the price of the commodity sold. The price fixed by the contract measures the obligation of the debtor, or the sum of money that he has to pay at a fixed date. Secondly, it serves as an ideal means of purchase. Although existing only in the promise of the buyer to pay, it causes the commodity to change hands. It is not before the day fixed for payment that the means of payment actually steps into circulation, leaves the hand of the buyer for that of the seller. The circulating medium was transformed into a hoard, because the process stopped short after the first phase, because the converted shape of the commodity, viz. The money, was withdrawn from circulation. The means of payment enters the circulation, but only after the commodity has left it. The money is no longer the means that brings about the process. It only brings it to a close, by stepping in as the absolute form of existence of exchange value, or as the universal commodity. The seller turned his commodity into money, in order thereby to satisfy some want. The hoarder did the same in order to keep his commodity in its money shape, and the debtor in order to be able to pay. If he do not pay, his goods will be sold by the sheriff. The value form of commodities, money, is therefore now the end and aim of a sale, and that, owing to a social necessity, springing out of the process of circulation itself. The buyer converts money back into commodities before he has turned commodities into money. In other words, he achieves the second metamorphosis of commodities before the first. The seller's commodity circulates and realizes its price, but only in the shape of a legal claim upon money. It is converted into a use value before it has been converted into money. The completion of its first metamorphosis follows only at a later period. Footnote. It will be seen from the following quotation from my book, which appeared in 1859, why I take no notice in the text of an opposite form. Contrariwise, in the process in money to commodity, the money can be alienated as a real means of purchase, and in that way the price of the commodity can be realized before the use value of the money is realized and the commodity actually delivered. This occurs constantly under the everyday form of prepayments, and it is under this form that the English government purchases opium from the ryots of India. In these cases, however, the money always acts as a means of purchase. Of course, capital also is advanced in the shape of money. This point of view, however, does not fall within the horizon of simple circulation. Zur Kritik, etc. End of footnote. The obligations falling due within a given period represent the sum of the prices of the commodities, the sale of which gave rise to those obligations. The quantity of gold necessary to realize this sum depends in the first instance on the rapidity of currency of the means of payment. That quantity is conditioned by two circumstances. First, the relations between debtors and creditors form a sort of chain, in such a way that A, when he receives money from his debtor B, straightway hands it over to C, his creditor, and so on. The second circumstance is the length of the intervals between the different due days of the obligations. The continuous chain of payments, or retarded first metamorphoses, is essentially different from that interlacing of the series of metamorphoses which we considered previously. By the currency of the circulating medium, the connection between buyers and sellers is not merely expressed. This connection is originated by, and exists in, the circulation alone. Contrariwise, the movement of the means of payment expresses a social relation that was in existence long before. The fact that a number of sales take place simultaneously and side by side limits the extent to which coin can be replaced by the rapidity of currency. On the other hand, this fact is a new lever in economizing the means of payment. In proportion as payments are concentrated at one spot, special institutions and methods are developed for their liquidation. Such, in the Middle Ages, were the virements at Lyon. The debts due to A from B to B to C from A, and so on, have only to be confronted with each other in order to annul each other to a certain extent like positive and negative quantities. There thus remains only a single balance to pay. The greater the amount of the payments concentrated, the less is this balance relatively to that amount, and the less is the mass of the means of payment in circulation. The function of money as the means of payment implies a contradiction without a terminus medius. In so far as the payments balance one another, money functions only ideally as money of account, as a measure of value. In so far as actual payments have to be made, money does not serve as a circulating medium, as a mere transient agent in the interchange of products, but as the individual incarnation of social labour, as the independent form of existence of exchange value, as the universal commodity. This contradiction comes to a head in those phases of industrial and commercial crises which are known as monetary crises. Footnote. The monetary crisis referred to in the text, being a phase of every crisis, must be clearly distinguished from that particular form of crisis which also is called a monetary crisis, but which may be produced by itself as an independent phenomenon in such a way as to react only indirectly on industry and commerce. The pivot of these crises is to be found in moneyed capital, and their sphere of direct action is therefore the sphere of that capital, viz. Banking. the stock exchange, and finance. End of footnote. Such a crisis occurs only where the ever-lengthening chain of payments and an artificial system of settling them has been fully developed. Whenever there is a general and extensive disturbance of this mechanism, no matter what its cause, money becomes suddenly and immediately transformed from its merely ideal shape of money of account into hard cash. Profane commodities can no longer replace it. The use value of commodities becomes valueless, and their value vanishes in the presence of its own independent form. On the eve of the crisis, the bourgeois, with the self-sufficiency that springs from intoxicating prosperity, declares money to be a vain imagination. Commodities alone are money. But now the cry is everywhere, money alone is a commodity. As the heart pants after fresh water, so pants his soul after money, the only wealth. Footnote. The sudden reversion from a system of credit to a system of hard cash heaps theoretical fright on top of the practical panic, and the dealers by whose agency circulation is affected shudder before the impenetrable mystery in which their own economic relations are involved. Karl Marx. The poor stand still, because the rich have no money to employ them, though they have the same land and hands to provide victuals and clothes as ever they had, which is the true riches of a nation, and not the money. John Bellers, Proposals for Raising a College of Industry, London, 1696. In a crisis, the antithesis between commodities and their value form, money, becomes heightened into an absolute contradiction. Hence, in such events, the form under which money appears is of no importance. The money famine continues, whether payments have to be made in gold or in credit money such as banknotes. Footnote. The following shows how such times are exploited by the Ami du Commerce. On one occasion, 1839, an old grasping banker in the city, in his private room, raised the lid of the desk he sat over, and displayed to a friend rolls of banknotes, saying with intense glee there were £600,000 of them. They were held to make money tight, and would all be let out after 3 o'clock on the same day. The Theory of Exchanges, the Bank Charter Act of 1844. 1864. The Observer, a semi-official government organ, contained the following paragraph on the 24th of April, 1864. Some very curious rumours are current of the means which have been resorted to in order to create a scarcity of banknotes. Questionable as it would seem to suppose that any trick of the kind would be adopted, the report has been so universal that it really deserves a mention. End of footnote. If we now consider the sum total of the money current during a given period, we shall find that, given the rapidity of currency of the circulating medium and of the means of payment, it is equal to the sum of the prices to be realized, plus the sum of the payments falling due, minus the payments that balance each other, minus finally the number of circuits in which the same piece of coin serves, in turn, as means of circulation and of payment. Hence, even when prices, rapidity of currency, and the extent of the economy in payments are given, the quantity of money current, and the mass of commodities circulating during a given period, such as a day, no longer correspond. Money that represents commodities long withdrawn from circulation continues to be current. Commodities circulate, whose equivalent in money will not appear on the scene till some future day. Moreover, the debts contracted each day, and the payments falling due on the same day, are quite incommensurable quantities. Footnote. The amount of purchases or contracts entered upon during the course of any given day will not affect the quantity of money afloat on that particular day, but, in the vast majority of cases, will resolve themselves into multifarious drafts upon the quantity of money which may be afloat at subsequent dates more or less distant. The bills granted or credits opened today need have no resemblance whatever, either in quantity, amount, or duration, to those granted or entered upon tomorrow or next day. Nay, many of today's bills and credits, when due, fall in with a mass of liabilities whose origins traverse a range of antecedent dates altogether indefinite. Bills at 12, 6, 3 months, or 1, often aggregating together to swell the common liabilities of one particular day. The currency theory reviewed, in a letter to the Scottish people, by a banker in England, Edinburgh, 1845. Credit money springs directly out of the function of money as a means of payment. Certificates of the debts owing for the purchased commodities circulate for the purpose of transferring those debts to others. On the other hand, to the same extent as the system of credit is extended, so is the function of money as a means of payment. In that character, it takes various forms peculiar to itself under which it makes itself at home in the sphere of great commercial transactions. Gold and silver coin, on the other hand, are mostly relegated to the sphere of retail trade. When the production of commodities has sufficiently extended itself, money begins to serve as the means of payment beyond the sphere of the circulation of commodities. It becomes the commodity that is the universal subject matter of all contracts. Footnote. The course of trade being thus turned from exchanging of goods for goods or delivering and taking to selling and paying, all the bargains are now stated upon the foot of a price in money. An Essay Upon Public Credit, 1710. End of footnote. Rents, taxes, and such like payments are transformed from payments in kind into money payments. To what extent this transformation depends upon the general conditions of production is shown, to take one example, by the fact that the Roman Empire twice failed in its attempt to levy all contributions in money. The unspeakable misery of the French agricultural population under Louis XIV, a misery so eloquently denounced by Boisguilbert, Marshal Vauban, and others, was due not only to the weight of the taxes, but also to the conversion of taxes in kind into money taxes. Footnote. Money has become the executioner of all things. Finance is the alembic that evaporates a frightful quantity of goods and commodities in order to obtain this fatal extract. Money declares war on the whole human race. Boisguilbert, Dissertation sur la nature des richesses, de l'argent et des tributs. Économiste Financier, Paris, 1843. End of footnote. In Asia, on the other hand, the fact that state taxes are chiefly composed of rents payable in kind depends on conditions of production that are reproduced with the regularity of natural phenomena, and this mode of payment tends in turn to maintain the ancient form of production. It is one of the secrets of the conservation of the Ottoman Empire. If the foreign trade, forced upon Japan by Europeans, should lead to the substitution of money rents for rents in kind, it would be all up with the exemplary agriculture of that country. The narrow economic conditions under which that agriculture is carried on will be swept away. In every country, certain days of the year become by habit recognized settling days for various large and recurrent payments. These dates depend, apart from other revolutions in the wheel of reproduction, on conditions closely connected with the seasons. They also regulate the dates for payments that have no direct connection with the circulation of commodities such as taxes, rents, and so on. The quantity of money requisite to make the payments, falling due on those dates all over the country, causes periodical, though merely superficial, perturbations in the economy of the medium of payment. Footnote. On Whitsuntide, 1824, says Mr. Craig, before the Commons Committee of 1826, there was such an immense demand for notes upon the banks of Edinburgh that by 11 o'clock they had not a note left in their custody. They sent round to all the different banks to borrow, but could not get them, and many of the transactions were adjusted by slips of paper only. Yet by 3 o'clock the whole of the notes were returned into the banks from which they had issued. It was a mere transfer from hand to hand. Although the average effective circulation of banknotes in Scotland is less than 3 million sterling, yet on certain paydays in the year, every single note in the possession of the bankers, amounting in the whole to about £7 million, is called into activity. On these occasions, the notes have a single and specific function to perform, and so soon as they have performed it, they flow back into the various banks from which they issued. See John Fullerton, Regulation of Currencies, London, 1845. In explanation, it should be stated that in Scotland, at the date of Fullerton's work, notes and not cheques were used to withdraw deposits. End of footnote. From the law of the rapidity of currency of the means of payment, it follows that the quantity of the means of payment required for all periodical payments, whatever their source, is in inverse proportion to the length of their periods. Footnote. To the question, if there were occasion to raise 40 millions per annum, whether the same 6 millions, gold, would suffice for such revolutions and circulations thereof as trade requires, Petty replies in his usual masterly manner. I answer yes, for the expense being 40 millions, if the revolutions were in such short circles, viz. Weekly, as happens among poor artisans and labourers who receive pay every Saturday, then 40/52nd parts of 1 million of money would answer these ends. But if the circles be quarterly, according to our custom of paying rent and gathering taxes, then 10 millions were requisite. Wherefore, supposing payments in general to be of a mixed circle between 1 week and 13, then add 10 millions to 40/52nd, the half of which will be 5½, so as if we have 5½ millions, we have enough. William Petty, Political Anatomy of Ireland, 1672. End of footnote. The development of money into a medium of payment makes it necessary to accumulate money against the dates fixed for the payment of the sums owing. While hoarding, as a distinct mode of acquiring riches, vanishes with the progress of civil society, the formation of reserves of the means of payment grows with that progress. C. Universal Money. When money leaves the home sphere of circulation, it strips off the local garbs which it there assumes of a standard of prices, of coin, of tokens, and of a symbol of value, and returns to its original form of bullion. In the trade between the markets of the world, the value of commodities is expressed so as to be universally recognized. Hence their independent value form also, in these cases, confronts them under the shape of universal money. It is only in the markets of the world that money acquires to the full extent the character of the commodity whose bodily form is also the immediate social incarnation of human labour in the abstract. Its real mode of existence in this sphere adequately corresponds to its ideal concept. Within the sphere of home circulation, there can be but one commodity which, by serving as a measure of value, becomes money. In the markets of the world, a double measure of value holds sway, gold and silver. Footnote. Hence the absurdity of every law prescribing that the banks of a country shall form reserves of that precious metal alone which circulates at home. The pleasant difficulties, thus self-created by the Bank of England, are well known. On the subject of the great epochs in the history of the changes in the relative value of gold and silver, see Karl Marx. Sir Robert Peel, by his Bank Act of 1844, sought to tide over the difficulty by allowing the Bank of England to issue notes against silver bullion, on condition that the reserve of silver should never exceed more than one-fourth of the reserve of gold, the value of silver being for that purpose estimated at its price in the London market. Added in the fourth German edition. We find ourselves once more in a period of serious change in the relative values of gold and silver. About 25 years ago, the ratio expressing the relative value of gold and silver was 15.5 to 1. Now it is approximately 22 to 1, and silver is still constantly falling as against gold. This is essentially the result of a revolution in the mode of production of both metals. Formerly, gold was obtained almost exclusively by washing it out from gold-bearing alluvial deposits, products of the weathering of auriferous rocks. Now this method has become inadequate and has been forced into the background by the processing of the quartz lodes themselves, a way of extraction which formerly was only of secondary importance, although well known to the ancients. Diodorus, Sicilian, Historische Bibliothek, 1828. Moreover, not only were new, huge silver deposits discovered in North America, in the western part of the Rocky Mountains, but these and the Mexican silver mines were really opened up by the laying of railways, which made possible the shipment of modern machinery and fuel, and in consequence the mining of silver on a very large scale at a low cost. However, there is a great difference in the way the two metals occur in the quartz lodes. The gold is mostly native, but disseminated throughout the quartz in minute quantities. The whole mass of the vein must therefore be crushed, and the gold either washed out or extracted by means of mercury. Often, 1 million grams of quartz barely yield 1/3, and very seldom 30 to 60 grams of gold. Silver is seldom found native. However, it occurs in special quartz that is separated from the lode with comparative ease and contains mostly 40 to 90% silver. Or it is contained in smaller quantities in copper, lead, and other ores, which in themselves are worthwhile working. From this alone, it is apparent that the labour expended on the production of gold is rather increasing, while that expended on silver production has decidedly decreased, which quite naturally explains the drop in the value of the latter. This fall in value would express itself in a still greater fall in price if the price of silver were not pegged even today by artificial means. But America's rich silver deposits have so far barely been tapped, and thus the prospects are that the value of this metal will keep on dropping for rather a long time to come. A still greater contributing factor here is the relative decrease in the requirement of silver for articles of general use and for luxuries, that is, its replacement by plated goods, aluminium, etc. One may thus gauge the utopianism of the bimetallist idea that compulsory international quotation will raise silver again to the old value ratio of 1 to 15.5. It is more likely that silver will forfeit its money function more and more in the markets of the world. Friedrich Engels. End of footnote. Money of the world serves as the universal medium of payment, as the universal means of purchasing, and as the universally recognized embodiment of all wealth. Its function as a means of payment in the settling of international balances is its chief one. Hence the watchword of the mercantilists, balance of trade. Footnote. The opponents themselves of the mercantile system, a system which considered the settlement of surplus trade balances in gold and silver as the aim of international trade, entirely misconceived the functions of money of the world. I have shown by the example of Ricardo in what way their false conception of the laws that regulate the quantity of the circulating medium is reflected in their equally false conception of the international movement of the precious metals. His erroneous dogma, an unfavourable balance of trade, never arises but from a redundant currency. The exportation of the coin is caused by its cheapness, and is not the effect but the cause of an unfavourable balance, already occurs in Barbon. The balance of trade, if there be one, is not the cause of sending away the money out of a nation, but that proceeds from the difference of the value of bullion in every country, in Barbon. McCulloch, in The Literature of Political Economy, a classified catalogue, London 1845, praises Barbon for this anticipation, but prudently passes over the naive forms in which Barbon closed the absurd supposition on which the currency principle is based. The absence of real criticism, and even of honesty, in that catalogue, culminates in the sections devoted to the history of the theory of money. The reason is that McCulloch, in this part of the work, is flattering Lord Overstone, whom he calls facile princeps argentinorum. End of footnote. Gold and silver serve as international means of purchasing, chiefly and necessarily in those periods when the customary equilibrium in the interchange of products between different nations is suddenly disturbed. And lastly, it serves as the universally recognized embodiment of social wealth, whenever the question is not of buying or paying, but of transferring wealth from one country to another, and whenever this transference in the form of commodities is rendered impossible, either by special conjunctures in the markets or by the purpose itself that is intended. Footnote. For instance, in subsidies, money loans for carrying on wars, or for enabling banks to resume cash payments, etc. It is the money form and no other of value that may be wanted. End of footnote. Just as every country needs a reserve of money for its home circulation, so too it requires one for external circulation in the markets of the world. The functions of hoards, therefore, arise in part out of the function of money as the medium of the home circulation and home payments, and in part out of its function of money of the world. Footnote. I would desire, indeed, no more convincing evidence of the competency of the machinery of the hordes in specie-paying countries to perform every necessary office of international adjustment without any sensible aid from the general circulation than the facility with which France, when but just recovering from the shock of a destructive foreign invasion, completed within the space of 27 months the payment of her forced contribution of nearly 20 millions to the Allied powers, and a considerable portion of the sum in specie, without any perceptible contraction or derangement of her domestic currency, or even any alarming fluctuation of her exchanges. Fullerton. Added in the 4th German edition. We have a still more striking example in the facility with which the same France was able in 1871-73 to pay off within 30 months a forced contribution more than 10 times as great, a considerable part of it likewise in specie. Friedrich Engels. End of footnote. For this latter function, the genuine money commodity, actual gold and silver, is necessary. On that account, Sir James Stuart, in order to distinguish them from their purely local substitutes, calls gold and silver money of the world. The current of the stream of gold and silver is a double one. On the one hand, it spreads itself from its sources over all the markets of the world, in order to become absorbed, to various extents, into the different national spheres of circulation, to fill the conduits of currency, to replace abraded gold and silver coins, to supply the material of articles of luxury, and to petrify into hoards. Footnote. Money is shared among the nations in accordance with their need for it, as it is always attracted by the products. Lutone. The mines, which are continually giving gold and silver, do give sufficient to supply such a needful balance to every nation. J. Vanderlint. End of footnote. This first current is started by the countries that exchange their labour realised in commodities for the labour embodied in the precious metals by gold and silver producing countries. On the other hand, there is a continual flowing backwards and forwards of gold and silver between the different national spheres of circulation, a current whose motion depends on the ceaseless fluctuations in the course of exchange. Footnote. Exchanges rise and fall every week, and at some particular times in the year run high against a nation, and at other times run as high on the contrary. N. Barbon. Countries in which the bourgeois form of production is developed to a certain extent limit the hoards concentrated in the strong rooms of the banks to the minimum required for the proper performance of their peculiar functions. Footnote. These various functions are liable to come into dangerous conflict with one another whenever gold and silver have also to serve as a fund for the conversion of banknotes. End of footnote. Whenever these hoards are strikingly above their average level, it is, with some exceptions, an indication of stagnation in the circulation of commodities, of an interruption in the even flow of their metamorphoses. Footnote. What money is more than of absolute necessity for a home trade is dead stock, and brings no profit to that country it's kept in, but, as it is transported in trade, as well as imported. John Bellars, Essays. What if we have too much coin? We may melt down the heaviest and turn it into the splendour of plate, vessels or utensils of gold or silver, or send it out as a commodity, where the same is wanted or desired, or let it out at interest, where interest is high. W. Petty, Quantulum Cunque. Money is but the fat of the body politic, whereof too much doth as often hinder its agility as too little makes it sick. As fat lubricates the motion of the muscles, feeds in want of victuals, fills up the uneven cavities, and beautifies the body, so doth money in the state quicken its action, feeds from abroad in time of dearth at home, evens accounts, and beautifies the whole, although more especially the particular persons that have it in plenty. W. Petty, Political Anatomy of Ireland. End of footnote. Part 2. Transformation of Money into Capital. Chapter 4. The General Formula for Capital. The circulation of commodities is the starting point of capital. The production of commodities, their circulation, and that more developed form of their circulation called commerce, these form the historical groundwork from which it rises. The modern history of capital dates from the creation in the 16th century of a world embracing commerce and a world embracing market. If we abstract from the material substance of the circulation of commodities, that is, from the exchange of the various use values, and consider only the economic forms produced by this process of circulation, we find its final result to be money. This final product of the circulation of commodities is the first form in which capital appears. As a matter of history, capital, as opposed to landed property, invariably takes the form at first of money. It appears as moneyed wealth, as the capital of the merchant and of the usurer. Footnote. The contrast between the power, based on the personal relations of dominion and servitude, that is conferred by landed property, and the impersonal power that is given by money, is well expressed by two French proverbs: Nulle terre sans seigneur, and l'argent n'a pas de maître. No land without its lord, and money has no master. End of footnote. But we have no need to refer to the origin of capital in order to discover that the first form of appearance of capital is money. We can see it daily under our very eyes. All new capital, to commence with, comes on the stage, that is, on the market, whether of commodities, labour, or money, even in our days, in the shape of money that by a definite process has to be transformed into capital. The first distinction we notice between money that is money only and money that is capital is nothing more than a difference in their form of circulation. The simplest form of the circulation of commodities is commodity to money to commodity. The transformation of commodities into money and the change of the money back again into commodities, or selling in order to buy. But alongside of this form, we find another specifically different form, money to commodity to money, the transformation of money into commodities, and the change of commodities back again into money, or buying, in order to sell. Money that circulates in the latter manner is thereby transformed into, becomes, capital, and is already potentially capital. Now let us examine the circuit money to commodity to money a little closer. It consists, like the other, of two antithetical phases. In the first phase, money to commodity, or the purchase, the money is changed into a commodity. In the second phase, commodity to money, or the sale, the commodity is changed back again into money. The combination of these two phases constitutes the single movement whereby money is exchanged for a commodity, and the same commodity is again exchanged for money, whereby a commodity is bought in order to be sold, or, neglecting the distinction in form between buying and selling, whereby a commodity is bought with money, and then money is bought with a commodity. Footnote. With money one buys commodities, and with commodities one buys money. Mercier de la Rivière, L'Ordre Naturel et Essentiel des Sociétés Politiques. End of footnote. The result, in which the phases of the process vanish, is the exchange of money for money, money to money. If I purchase 2,000 pounds of cotton for £100, and resell the 2,000 pounds of cotton for £110, I have in fact exchanged £100 for £110. Money for money. Now it is evident that the circuit money to commodity to money would be absurd and without meaning if the intention were to exchange by this means two equal sums of money, £100 for £100. The miser's plan would be far simpler and surer. He sticks to his £100 instead of exposing it to the dangers of circulation. And yet, whether the merchant who has paid £100 for his cotton sells it for £110, or lets it go for £100 or even £50, his money has, at all events, gone through a characteristic and original movement, quite different in kind from that which it goes through in the hands of the peasant, who sells corn and with the money thus set free buys clothes. We have therefore to examine first the distinguishing characteristics of the forms of the circuits money to commodity to money and commodity to money to commodity, and in doing this the real difference that underlies the mere difference of form will reveal itself. Let us see in the first place what the two forms have in common. Both circuits are resolvable into the same two antithetical phases, commodity to money, a sale, and money to commodity, a purchase. In each of these phases, the same material elements, a commodity and money, and the same economic dramatis personae, a buyer and a seller, confront one another. Each circuit is the unity of the same two antithetical phases, and in each case this unity is brought about by the intervention of three contracting parties, of whom one only sells, one only buys, while the third both buys and sells. What, however, first and foremost distinguishes the circuit commodity to money to commodity from the circuit money to commodity to money is the inverted order of succession of the two phases. The simple circulation of commodities begins with the sale and ends with a purchase, while the circulation of money as capital begins with a purchase and ends with a sale. In the one case, both the starting point and the goal are commodities. In the other, they are money. In the first form, the movement is brought about by the intervention of money, in the second, by that of a commodity. In the circulation commodity to money to commodity, the money is in the end converted into a commodity that serves as a use value. It is spent once and for all. In the inverted form, money to commodity to money, on the contrary, the buyer lays out money in order that, as a seller, he may recover money. By the purchase of his commodity, he throws money into circulation, in order to withdraw it again by the sale of the same commodity. He lets the money go, but only with the sly intention of getting it back again. The money, therefore, is not spent. It is merely advanced. Footnote. When a thing is bought in order to be sold again, the sum employed is called money advanced. When it is bought not to be sold, it may be said to be expended. James Stewart, Works, etc. Edited by General Sir James Stewart, his son, 1805. End of footnote. In the circuit commodity to money to commodity, the same piece of money changes its place twice. The seller gets it from the buyer and pays it away to another seller. The complete circulation, which begins with the receipt, concludes with the payment of money for commodities. It is the very contrary in the circuit money to commodity to money. Here it is not the piece of money that changes its place twice, but the commodity. The buyer takes it from the hands of the seller and passes it into the hands of another buyer. Just as in the simple circulation of commodities, the double change of place of the same piece of money effects its passage from one hand into another, so here the double change of place of the same commodity brings about the reflux of the money to its point of departure. Such reflux is not dependent on the commodity being sold for more than was paid for it. This circumstance influences only the amount of the money that comes back. The reflux itself takes place so soon as the purchased commodity is resold. In other words, so soon as the circuit money to commodity to money is completed. We have here, therefore, a palpable difference between the circulation of money as capital and its circulation as mere money. The circuit, commodity to money to commodity, comes completely to an end, so soon as the money brought in by the sale of one commodity is abstracted again by the purchase of another. If, nevertheless, there follows a reflux of money to its starting point, This can only happen through a renewal or repetition of the operation. If I sell a quarter of corn for £3, and with this £3 buy clothes, the money, so far as I am concerned, is spent and done with. It belongs to the clothes merchant. If I now sell a quarter of corn, money indeed flows back to me, not, however, as a sequel to the first transaction, but in consequence of its repetition. The money again leaves me, so soon as I complete this second transaction by a fresh purchase. Therefore, in the circuit commodity to money to commodity, the expenditure of money has nothing to do with its reflux. On the other hand, in money to commodity to money, the reflux of the money is conditioned by the very mode of its expenditure. Without this reflux, the operation fails or the process is interrupted and incomplete, owing to the absence of its complementary and final phase, the sale. The circuit commodity to money to commodity starts with one commodity and finishes with another, which falls out of circulation and into consumption. Consumption, the satisfaction of wants in one word use value, is its end and aim. The circuit money to commodity to money, on the contrary, commences with money and ends with money. Its leading motive, and the goal that attracts it, is therefore mere exchange value. In the simple circulation of commodities, the two extremes of the circuit have the same economic form. They are both commodities, and commodities of equal value. But they are also use values, differing in their qualities, as, for example, corn and clothes. The exchange of products of the different materials in which the labour of society is embodied forms here the basis of the movement. It is otherwise in the circulation money to commodity to money, which at first sight appears purposeless because tautological. Both extremes have the same economic form. They are both money, and therefore are not qualitatively different use values. For money is but the converted form of commodities, in which their particular use values vanish. To exchange £100 for cotton, and then this same cotton again for £100, is merely a roundabout way of exchanging money for money, the same for the same, and appears to be an operation just as purposeless as it is absurd. Footnote. One does not exchange money for money, says Mercier de la Rivière to the mercantilists. In a work which ex professo treats of trade and speculation, occurs the following. All trade consists in the exchange of things of different kinds, and the advantage, to the merchant, arises out of this difference. To exchange a pound of bread against a pound of bread would be attended with no advantage. Hence, trade is advantageously contrasted with gambling, which consists in a mere exchange of money for money. Thomas Corbett, An Inquiry into the Causes and Modes of the Wealth of Individuals, or the Principles of Trade and Speculation, explained, London, 1841. Although Corbett does not see that money to money, the exchange of money for money, is the characteristic form of circulation not only of merchants' capital, but of all capital, yet at least he acknowledges that this form is common to gambling and to one species of trade, viz. Speculation. But then comes McCulloch, and makes out that to buy in order to sell is to speculate. And thus the difference between speculation and trade vanishes. Every transaction in which an individual buys produce in order to sell it again is, in fact, a speculation. McCulloch, A Dictionary Practical, etc. of Commerce, 1847. With much more naivety, Pinto, the Pindar of the Amsterdam Stock Exchange, remarks, "Trade is a game, and nothing can be won from beggars. If one won everything from everybody all the time, it would be necessary to give back the greater part of the profit voluntarily in order to begin the game again. Pinto, Traité de la Circulation et du Crédit, 1771. End of footnote. One sum of money is distinguishable from another only by its amount. The character and tendency of the process money to commodity to money is therefore not due to any qualitative difference between its extremes, both being money, but solely to their quantitative difference. More money is withdrawn from circulation at the finish than was thrown into it at the start. The cotton that was bought for £100 is perhaps resold for £100 plus £10, or £110. The exact form of this process is therefore money to commodity to incremented money, where incremented money equals money plus increment, equals the original sum advanced plus an increment. This increment or excess over the original value I call surplus value. The value originally advanced, therefore, not only remains intact while in circulation, but adds to itself a surplus value or expands itself. It is this movement that converts it into capital. Of course, it is also possible that in commodity to money to commodity, the two extremes commodity to commodity, say corn and clothes, may represent different quantities of value. The farmer may sell his corn above its value, or may buy clothes at less than their value. He may, on the other hand, be done by the clothes merchant. Yet, in the form of circulation now under consideration, such differences in value are purely accidental. The fact that the corn and the clothes are equivalents does not deprive the process of all meaning, as it does in money to commodity to money. The equivalence of their values is rather a necessary condition to its normal course. The repetition or renewal of the act of selling in order to buy is kept within bounds by the very object it aims at, namely, consumption or the satisfaction of definite wants, an aim that lies altogether outside the sphere of circulation. But when we buy in order to sell, we, on the contrary, begin and end with the same thing, money, exchange value. And thereby the movement becomes interminable. No doubt M becomes M plus increment. £100 become £110. But when viewed in their qualitative aspect alone, £110 are the same as £100, namely money, and, considered quantitatively, £110 is, like £100, a sum of definite and limited value. If now the £110 be spent as money, they cease to play their part. They are no longer capital. Withdrawn from circulation, they become petrified into a hoard, and though they remained in that state till doomsday, not a single farthing would accrue to them. If, then, the expansion of value is once aimed at, there is just the same inducement to augment the value of the £110 as that of the £100, for both are but limited expressions for exchange value, and therefore both have the same vocation to approach, by quantitative increase, as near as possible to absolute wealth. Momentarily, indeed, the value originally advanced, the £100, is distinguishable from the surplus value of £10 that is annexed to it during circulation, but the distinction vanishes immediately. At the end of the process, we do not receive with one hand the original £100 and with the other the surplus value of £10, we simply get a value of £110, which is in exactly the same condition and fitness for commencing the expanding process as the original £100 was. Money ends the movement only to begin it again. Footnote. Capital is divisible into the original capital and the profit, the increment to the capital, although in practice this profit is immediately turned into capital and set in motion with the original. Friedrich Engels, Umrisse zu einer Kritik der Nationalökonomie in Deutsch-Französische Jahrbücher, herausgegeben von Arnold Ruger und Karl Marx, 1844. End of footnote. Therefore, the final result of every separate circuit in which a purchase and consequent sale are completed forms of itself the starting point of a new circuit. The simple circulation of commodities, selling in order to buy, is a means of carrying out a purpose unconnected with circulation, namely the appropriation of use values, the satisfaction of wants. The circulation of money as capital is, on the contrary, an end in itself, for the expansion of value takes place only within this constantly renewed movement. The circulation of capital has therefore no limits. Footnote. Aristotle opposes économique to crematistique. He starts from the former. So far as it is the art of gaining a livelihood, it is limited to procuring those articles that are necessary to existence, and useful either to a household or the state. True wealth consists of such values in use, for the quantity of possessions of this kind, capable of making life pleasant, is not unlimited. There is, however, a second mode of acquiring things, to which we may, by preference and with correctness, give the name of crematistic, and in this case there appear to be no limits to riches and possessions. Trade, a capellica is literally retail trade, and Aristotle takes this kind because in it values in use predominate, does not in its nature belong to crematistic, for here the exchange has reference only to what is necessary to themselves, the buyer or seller. Therefore, as he goes on to show, the original form of trade was barter, but with the extension of the latter, there arose the necessity for money. On the discovery of money, barter of necessity developed into capellica, into trading in commodities, and this again, in opposition to its original tendency, grew into crematistic, into the art of making money. Now, crematistic is distinguishable from economic in this way, that in the case of crematistic, circulation is the source of riches, and it appears to revolve about money, for money is the beginning and end of this kind of exchange. Therefore also riches, such as crematistic strives for, are unlimited. Just as every art that is not a means to an end but an end in itself has no limit to its aims because it seeks constantly to approach nearer and nearer to that end, while those arts that pursue means to an end are not boundless, since the goal itself imposes a limit upon them, so with crematistic, there are no bounds to its aims, these aims being absolute wealth. Economic, not crematistic, has a limit. The object of the former is something different from money, of the latter the augmentation of money. By confounding these two forms, which overlap each other, some people have been led to look upon the preservation and increase of money ad infinitum as the end and aim of economic. Aristoteles, De Rep. End of footnote. As the conscious representative of this movement, the possessor of money becomes a capitalist. His person, or rather his pocket, is the point from which the money starts and to which it returns. The expansion of value, which is the objective basis or mainspring of the circulation money to commodity to money, becomes his subjective aim. And it is only in so far as the appropriation of ever more and more wealth in the abstract becomes the sole motive of his operations that he functions as a capitalist. That is, as capital personified and endowed with consciousness and a will. Footnote. Commodities, here used in the sense of use values, are not the terminating object of the trading capitalist. Money is his terminating object. T. Chalmers, On Political Economy, etc., 1832. End of footnote. Use values must therefore never be looked upon as the real aim of the capitalist, neither must the profit on any single transaction. The restless, never-ending process of profit-making alone is what he aims at. Footnote. The merchant counts the money he has made as almost nothing. He always looks to the future. A. Genovese, Lezioni di Economia Civile, 1765, Custodi's edition of Italian Economists, Parte Moderna. End of footnote. Footnote. The inextinguishable passion for gain, the auri sacra fames, will always lead capitalists. McCulloch, The Principles of Political Economy, 1830. This view, of course, does not prevent the same McCulloch and others of his kidney, when in theoretical difficulties, such, for example, as the question of overproduction, from transforming the same capitalist into a moral citizen, whose sole concern is for use values, and who even develops an insatiable hunger for boots, hats, eggs, calico, and other extremely familiar sorts of use values. End of footnote. This boundless greed after riches, this passionate chase after exchange value, is common to the capitalist and the miser. But while the miser is merely a capitalist gone mad, the capitalist is a rational miser. The never-ending augmentation of exchange value, which the miser strives after by seeking to save his money from circulation, is attained by the more acute capitalist by constantly throwing it afresh into circulation. Footnote. That infinity which things do not possess, they possess in circulation. Galliani. End of footnote. The independent form, that is, the money form, which the value of commodities assumes in the case of simple circulation, serves only one purpose, namely their exchange, and vanishes in the final result of the movement. On the other hand, in the circulation money to commodity to money, both the money and the commodity represent only different modes of existence of value itself. The money its general mode, and the commodity its particular, or, so to say, disguised mode. Footnote. It is not matter which makes capital, but the value of that matter. J. B. Say, Traité d'économie politique, 1817. End of footnote. It is constantly changing from one form to the other without thereby becoming lost, and thus assumes an automatically active character. If we now take in turn each of the two different forms which self-expanding value successively assumes in the course of its life, we then arrive at these two propositions. Capital is money. Capital is commodities. Footnote. Currency employed in producing articles is capital. MacLeod, The Theory and Practice of Banking, 1855. Capital is commodities. James Mill, Elements of Political Economy, 1821. End of footnote. In truth, however, value is here the active factor in a process in which, while constantly assuming the form in turn of money and commodities, it at the same time changes in magnitude, differentiates itself by throwing off surplus value from itself. The original value, in other words, expands spontaneously. For the movement, in the course of which it adds surplus value, is its own movement. Its expansion, therefore, is automatic expansion. Because it is value, it has acquired the occult quality of being able to add value to itself. It brings forth living offspring, or at least lays golden eggs. Value, therefore, being the active factor in such a process, and assuming at one time the form of money, at another that of commodities, but through all these changes preserving itself and expanding, it requires some independent form by means of which its identity may at any time be established. And this form it possesses only in the shape of money. It is under the form of money that value begins and ends, and begins again, every act of its own spontaneous generation. It began by being £100, it is now £110, and so on. But the money itself is only one of the two forms of value. Unless it takes the form of some commodity, it does not become capital. There is here no antagonism, as in the case of hoarding, between the money and commodities. The capitalist knows that all commodities, however scurvy they may look, or however badly they may smell, are in faith and in truth money, inwardly circumcised Jews, and what is more, a wonderful means whereby out of money to make more money. In simple circulation, commodity to money to commodity, the value of commodities attained at most a form independent of their use values, that is, the form of money. But that same value, now in the circulation money to commodity to money, or the circulation of capital, suddenly presents itself as an independent substance, endowed with a motion of its own, passing through a life process of its own, in which money and commodities are mere forms which it assumes and casts off in turn. Nay, more. Instead of simply representing the relations of commodities, it enters now, so to say, into private relations with itself. It differentiates itself as original value from itself as surplus value. As the father differentiates himself from himself qua the son, yet both are one and of one age. For only by the surplus value of £10 does the £100 originally advanced become capital, and so soon as this takes place, so soon as the son and by the son the father is begotten, so soon does their difference vanish, and they again become one. £110. Value therefore now becomes value in process, money in process, and, as such, capital. It comes out of circulation, enters into it again, preserves and multiplies itself within its circuit, comes back out of it with expanded bulk, and begins the same round ever afresh. Money to incremented money, money which begets money, such is the description of capital from the mouths of its first interpreters, the mercantilists. Buying in order to sell, or more accurately buying in order to sell dearer, money to commodity to incremented money, appears certainly to be a form peculiar to one kind of capital alone, namely merchants' capital. But industrial capital, too, is money that is changed into commodities and by the sale of these commodities is reconverted into more money. The events that take place outside the sphere of circulation, in the interval between the buying and the selling, do not affect the form of this movement. Lastly, in the case of interest-bearing capital, the circulation money to commodity to incremented money appears abridged. We have its result without the intermediate stage, in the form money to incremented money, en style lapidaire, so to say, money that is worth more money, value that is greater than itself. Money to commodity to incremented money is therefore in reality the general formula of capital, as it appears prima facie within the sphere of circulation. Chapter 5. Contradictions in the general formula of capital. The form which circulation takes when money becomes capital is opposed to all the laws we have hitherto investigated bearing on the nature of commodities, value, and money, and even of circulation itself. What distinguishes this form from that of the simple circulation of commodities is the inverted order of succession of the two antithetical processes, sale and purchase. How can this purely formal distinction between these processes change their character, as it were, by magic? But that is not all. The inversion has no existence for two out of the three persons who transact business together. As capitalist, I buy commodities from A and sell them again to B, but as a simple owner of commodities, I sell them to B and then purchase fresh ones from A. A and B see no difference between the two sets of transactions. They are merely buyers or sellers, and I on each occasion meet them as a mere owner of either money or commodities, as a buyer or a seller, and what is more, in both sets of transactions I am opposed to A only as a buyer and to B only as a seller, to the one only as money, to the other only as commodities, and to neither of them as capital or a capitalist, or as representative